Well, if you're like me, you've heard lots of dull speeches, dozens of them, in fact. And if you're like me, you live in fear of delivering a boring talk, one where yawns are popping out of the audience within minutes. What to do about it? Comedy is one answer. There are ways to inject a little levity into any talk that will spice it up and practically guarantee a talk that's definitely not in the dull category. Here to talk about it is David Nihil. He's the author of Do You Talk Funny? 7 Comedy Habits to Become a Better and Funnier Public Speaker, and he speaks in town this week. And David, welcome. So nice to have you.
Oh, thanks very much for having me. Great to be on the show. Well, that book does come with an Irish accent. We should warn your listeners.
Look out for that, right?
Yeah.
Well, you were like everybody else at one point in your life, David. Speaking to an audience absolutely brought you to your knees. How'd you overcome it?
Oh, yeah. Not only brought me to my knees, I think it left me nearly wanting to lay an egg. It was that bad. And I'm certainly guilty for putting a lot of people to sleep in my time as well. But it may seem like the worst plan ever, but it was an enforced road of using stand-up comedy to get over that fear, which I think might be most people's worst nightmare around the area of public speaking.
But, you know, a lot of folks are going to say, hey, that's a really good idea. I love comedy in a speech that I listen to. But, hey, I'm not a very funny person. So what about that, David?
Yeah, it's funny. I think if you asked a group of people where I'm from in Ireland if they thought they were funny, especially if they had a couple of pints on them, they would probably say absolutely yes. And we are funny. But I think if you ask a group of people in the States, the funny thing is they tend to say, no, you know, I'm not funny. And my belief sincerely is that everybody is funny in some way or other. We just have never been taught how to take something we find humorous and communicate it to somebody else in the shortest, most effective form possible. It's not like comedians come to your school or come to your job and teach you how to do that. And maybe they should. Our work would probably be a lot more fun. But I believe everybody's funny. I believe there's a way for them to be funny on stage, certainly.
Well, give us just a tip or two that might help us translate that idea that everybody's funny and we have it inside us to actually injecting that into a speech that we might be giving.
Yeah, well, I think it's going back to the fine words of Shakespeare, and I won't hold it against him being English whatsoever on this one and draw from his wisdom, that brevity is levity. And I think comedians have that forced upon them. They have no choice. They're only given 4 or 5 minutes to work with, whereas in the last few years, and up until very recently, a keynote speaker would have been given 60 minutes, so there was no enforced time period for them to make their point. So really, comedians will always use a joke structure, which is basically setting up your story, so you don't even have to write a clever witticism. You just have to tell a story, but identify the key part of that story and then get to that key funny part in the shortest amount of words possible, actually writing it out. So setting it out to make it as relevant to as many people as you can and get to your funny quicker. So I think we've all been to those dinners or family get-togethers at Christmas where we sit around and somebody launches into a long story and they're like, oh, I was going down the road and on the road I saw a car and, oh, I need a new car and then had my jacket on. I'm not sure which jacket you're. All right, wait a minute. What's this story about? And I think we're all guilty of that, or we've all been through those moments where somebody gets lost in getting to the point. Comedians are masters of finding that key funny part and then ruthlessly stripping out every word before it to really only leave the absolutely necessary. And I think that just by following that alone, you're guaranteed to get more laughs and more of the time.
You know, David, in your book, you refer frequently to the TED Talks that are just took place in Kansas City this week and are taking place all across the country. TED Talks are known for their brevity. I think 18 minutes is the time limit on those. And I'm wondering, are TED Talks sort of what impact are they having on the world of public speaking and this emphasis on brevity that you just mentioned?
Well, absolutely. So, I mean, a great example of that was Monica Lewinsky. In recent times, she gave a TED Talk. And obviously, this lady has a hell of a lot to say. You would be very excited. If she was on TV a couple of years ago giving all that information, that could be a couple of hours worth of an interview. And it was in certain forms. And all of a sudden, somebody of her stature, somebody with so much of interest to say to the general public on a presidential level, is given 22. I think she went over a bit and she did 22 minutes. But it really is changing that delivery of information to reflect modern society, where we're all a bit ADD and we may be stuck in the room with you, but we have this device or tablet in our hand which allows us to switch off. So I think one thing, it's that enforced brevity. Number two, one thing every one of the top 10 TED Talks at the moment has has in common is they are all funny. And some of them, if you actually study them, they get more laughs per minute than the funniest movies of all time. Which is so that's really changing the form of public speaking, because now are you not only expected to be informative and brief, you're expected to be entertaining as well. And I guess the core argument of my book, and the reason I chose comedy to explain it that way by referring to TED Talks, was to prove that this is happening on a very large stage on a business level, and it's no longer comedians that are just funny. Modern society is now conditioned to receive data with a punchline.
This was interesting to me. You quote a man named John Medina, who's a biologist and author of the best-selling book Brain Rules, and he said this, David, the brain doesn't pay attention to boring things. So that, it seems to me, places even more of a premium on humor, or how do you look at it?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you just are exposed to so much information these days. If there isn't a level of humor in there, there isn't something that really grabs you about it, you don't remember it. And John Medina's argument is that that moment of dopamine, the release of the positive experience towards the information you're getting, someone creates that mental post-it note in your mind that says, remember this. And laughter is a really quick way to making sure, in terms of psychology, that you stand out in somebody's mind.
You also point out in here that humor lowers defenses and makes audiences even more receptive to your message. Why does it do that?
Well, definitely, because it breaks down those barriers. It gives you an instant injection of happiness. You're more receptive to something. If somebody starts off with something funny, you automatically like them. It draws you into whatever they're saying. And that's something that used car salesmen have known for a long time, but not only on that level, up to presidential level. And we're seeing that, I think, topically at the moment with Donald Trump, who's somebody who you watch because, it's controversial, but it's entertainment. And some of your listeners will be saying, all right, but we've had enough of entertainment from this fella. And we want some message to it. As coming from a country that had a turkey run for president in 1997, a stuffed turkey at that, I see a lot of message similarities there on those ones.
I don't think of Donald Trump as humorous, like he's cracking jokes. Unless you find his style of delivery humorous, and I would understand that. But I don't find him humorous in the sense that you're advising, that, hey, inject levity into talks that you give.
Yeah, and he's not, because he tends to go for controversial statements.
There you go.
The funny thing is, he is dominating social media feeds. Like, if you want to get traction where people are going for entertainment, then you have to be the entertainment. Now, he's a little bit different in the world of comedy. He's kind of like watching a train wreck, and you're like, all right, where's this going to end? And which is very much linked to comedy as well. I mean, the basic structure of writing a joke is, it's like creating a path of a train going down the tracks. And then the punchline, or the break in expectations, is the bit that really surprises you and flips your expectations. I think watching Donald Trump, you're expecting that train wreck to happen. You're like, what's he going to say next? So I think the entertainment he's tapping into, although similar in structure, it's, as you rightly say, quite different.
I'm talking with David Nihil. He's the author of Do You Talk Funny? 7 Comedy Habits to Become a Better and Funnier Public Speaker. He'll be speaking at 6:30 Thursday evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. To reserve a seat, go to kclibrary.org. That's 6:30 this coming Thursday evening. Now, you quote a man, someone else here in your book, Darren LaCroix, as saying the key to public speaking success is stage time, stage time, stage time, meaning what?
Well, basically repetition in the amount you do it. So if you go, it's very much along the lines of Malcolm Gladwell and his 10,000 hours rule to make a master. If you simply take that and apply it to public speaking, you'll realize outside preachers and pastors, there's very few people that are on stage that often to consider themselves masters of public speaking. And if you speak to most experts in public speaking, they will tell you comedians are the true masters, because they're on stage. They clock up those hours faster than anybody else.
You tell a great story. Who was it who used to speak to an empty audience? I think it was Steve Martin you talk about
Steve
in
Martin.
The book.
And well,
tell
Steve
us what
Martin
he used to go through.
Yeah, I mean, Steve Martin and every one of us. I think anyone that will do comedy, the bit that takes a lot of getting used to is one night you can be talking literally to one or two people or nobody whatsoever, and the next night you can be in front of 1,500 people. And that will often happen, if not in the same night, just two or three nights apart. So I think it's quite an emotional roller coaster ride to train yourself to get ready for that and give the same performance no matter if you're speaking to 2 or 1,000. So what he went through was performing with his banjo for nearly 10 years in cafes with nobody whatsoever some nights, and ultimately went on to be doing it regularly, the same jokes and the same stories in front of 15,000 people.
Yeah, in excess. He would speak to empty audiences, and he had to do it because he was paid to do it, just in case somebody walked by and looked in the room and wondered, well, who's that guy? He would be speaking to an empty room sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. But the funny thing is, the techniques you pick up speaking to that empty room and just vocalizing your own words. So a lot of public speakers, when they prepare, they just get an idea in their head, but they don't actually vocalize it. And a lot of the time what happens is when you vocalize something, you tend to add in little bits that you wouldn't if you were writing it alone. And it's the same reason Steve Martin was doing it, as a lot of playwrights would be doing it. A lot of people who are writing for TV series, they will get in front of a mic and try and tell the same story and use the same material and record it. The conscious editing and recording is what comedians are fantastic at doing that your average business speaker generally doesn't do. Hmm. And for good reason, we all kind of hate listening to ourselves in every way, shape, or form.
Well, let's turn to the 7 principles that you outline in this book to make you a better speaker and a funnier one, too. And maybe I should first offer our listeners, if you want to call in and ask David a question, 816-235-2888 is our number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. The first principle in the book, begin with a story. Why begin with a story, David?
Well, stories are basically our human currency of contact in any way, shape, or form. If it wasn't just because it gave Irish people like me a sneaky advantage, because we do love a good story. And that stereotype we will happily own. But it's just, if you want someone to remember you, if you want to connect with them, a story is the most effective form, and it ties very much into John Medina's brain research that our mind is hardwired to remember stories. So you may go along to a comedy show, and I'm sure we can all remember a time where we saw a comedian and he made us laugh hysterically for up to 60 minutes, but you struggle to remember any of the things he actually said. Whereas we put that same information in a story format, all of a sudden you have something to and people emotionally can connect to. So the most powerful thing you can do is tell a story in a way that allows people to see themselves within that story. And if you mix that with comedy, which a lot of the greatest comedians in the States and Ireland and in Scotland, like Billy Connolly, have done, is be a master storyteller and leave the audience with something that they can tell for you, which allows them to spread their message for you.
You know,
but you're into something a whole level more powerful and, more importantly, more memorable.
And if somebody out there is saying, well, yeah, stories are great, but I don't have any stories, you advise personal stories. Everybody's got a personal story or two, right?
Oh, absolutely. And the funny thing is, comedians document those religiously. Like every day they see something where there's a note with the humor, they will write it down straight away. And when I always say to people, you need to tell your own stories, they're like, oh, I haven't got anything. But as you forcibly start to document this, and every time you see something funny, I mean, the world is a mad place these days. It gives you a lot of entertainment. All you have to do is take note of it, rewrite it, and then tell people about it. So yesterday, for example, I was driving down the street and there was a guy walking down the middle of the road with what looked like a selfie pole in his hand. And the average motorist in modern days is now thinking, my God, what is that guy doing taking a selfie in the middle of the road? And of course, it wasn't a selfie pole. He was a blind guy and he'd struggled literally into the middle of the road without realizing. But because of the lunacy and the craze we have with selfie poles all of a sudden, now everybody's first reaction is, why is that guy taking a selfie? And nobody had actually helped him. And I had to do a double take myself before I stopped and helped him get off the road and get back to safety. But I think it's just documenting those little incidents every day and then linking them to another topic and retelling them in the most effective fashion.
And I bet
like there's humor in there somewhere. I don't know where it is yet, but there's certainly a humorous link there between the mistake everybody saw and what was actually happening.
Did you use the analogy in the book about a dog eating spaghetti, which I just thought was terrific? What a great image.
Yeah, no, I like that one. I think it was linked to a guy telling a story of his first kiss.
Yeah, his first kiss. That's right. That's where I read that.
And I think we can all relate to that because it's a moment where we all had pure pain. And I know I've slapped a few people with spaghetti in my time, and I'm sure you may have as well.
Yeah. You say the secret sauce of good stories can be boiled down to this. Who wants what and what stops them? Translate that for me.
Well, it's basically every movie script you've ever seen. It's always the hero's journey. I mean, it's the real definition of it. But the hero's journey is basically, there's a main character in your story. He's always trying to get someone. And even if you take that as simple as something like a sitcom called Friends, you know, you're like, what relationship here? What love interests are going on behind the scenes? Oh, Joey wants Rachel. Rachel wants whoever. What's stopping that relationship from happening? And I think you'll see that same thing turn out in all of the greatest movies you've ever seen. If you break down the plot, you'll be like, yeah, it was someone trying to get something and another character stopping them from getting it. And hopefully he got it in the end. And if he didn't, there was a twist in the tale. Huh. So I think most great stories break down to that formula, which is who wants what and what stops them from getting it.
And when you give a talk with these personal stories in here, David, you suggest that the speaker don't use notes. Just tell the story, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I think notes in modern days, one, a lot of conference organizers don't provide any way. And that's another impact of TED as well, that it's just very much you exposed to the audience with no notes in your hand and no podium to rely on and nothing between you and the audience. And that's very much because you need to see somebody to be able to trust them. So TED have very much incorporated that. But if you walk out with notes in your hand, you're showing people that you don't really know what you're about to talk about. And you may not remember it, which is not a good signal to communicate off the bat.
And you say the last line of the story should be absolutely clear in your head even before you start.
Yeah, exactly. So I would always write a story or always tell a story with the last line in mind, so people know it is a natural conclusion to that story. But it gives you a very structured approach to creating it once you know what the end is. So what's the key takeaway? Or if you're trying to be funny, what was the key funny thing that happened? What are you going to leave people with? What's the impression you want them to have?
You also talk in the book about something called the joke funnel. What's the joke funnel?
Yeah, it sounds fancy. It's nothing like that funnel in American universities they make us Irish visiting students drink beer out of. It may have influenced me when I got over here, but joke funnel is basically a way for you to draw as wide an audience in as possible to the start of the funnel. So if I have a story about me being in China and I start that off with this one time I was in China, well, very few people can relate to that because they haven't been in China. A lot of people might not have even traveled overseas. So I would have to start that story with this one time being in a new place can be uncomfortable. Or being in a new place can throw up strange things. Now I've brought as many people into the funnel or into the journey or the story with me as I possibly can, which gives me the license to tell my own story. So the joke funnel is a way of bringing as many people as you can along for the ride, but making sure that you get very concise. So you want to use joke structure, which is the setting up the funny part of your story with as few words as possible, and then playing around with it. And the joke funnel is basically you throw in some ideas, and at the bottom end, you eventually want it to be funny once you play around with it and rewrite it. And you want as many people to be able to see themselves in your story, relate to it, or step back and go, oh, yeah, that's funny. I never thought of it like that.
I really like the story you tell in here about the one-time CEO of Kimberly-Clark, a man named Darwin Smith, who gave a talk once that's a terrific example of a good punchline and its ability to release tension. What did Darwin Smith do before his own employees once?
Yeah, he basically set it up like somebody had just passed away with a speech he was giving and asked him to get together in a moment of silence, what turned out to be a minute of silence. And at the end, he declared that minute of silence for one of their competitors, which was basically their war cry to, okay, we stuffed those guys. But it was nice. It's just all about creating that little moment of anticipation. And comedians are really, really good at doing that. But, you know, not only them, see, leading CEOs as well sometimes.
Hey, our producer, Danny Alexander, wanted me to ask you about how you came to America and the story about your diplomatic visa. How did that play out?
Yeah, thankfully, I never made known that there was any comedic intentions back then when they gave me that job. But yeah, I got a diplomatic visa helping Irish companies here in the U.S. And for some reason, the first job they gave me was arranging the Irish president's visit to Vancouver, which I was given an open guest list basically to invite important business people, which I just invited all my family, friends, and basically anybody. And it ended with our president was giving a speech, very emotional, asking Irish people with skills overseas to come home to Ireland, that the country needs them. And my uncle decided this was a good moment to tackle the president on the stage and give her a big hug and Microsoft headquarters, which was It didn't work out the best, and he is 6'5" and pretty imposing looking. It didn't end well. But you can hear that and all sorts of other wacky stories that we're not only going to be doing the library, but also the Crown Center Comedy as part of Kansas City Irish Festival.
Oh, great.
Just, Saturday and Sunday.
David Nihil again is the author of Do You Talk Funny? He speaks at 6:30 Thursday evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Library. To grab a seat, go to kclibrary.org. David, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.